Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This episode of Groundwire was produced by Carly Forbes on Fort William, First Nation, Anishinaabe Territory in Thunder Bay at CILU. I'm JL Chung, and
I'm Carly Forbes.
Low-wage temporary foreign workers in Canada will only be able to work 4 years in Canada, and then we'll have to leave for another 4 years.
You know, what happened to Cindy is unacceptable, and I think it's so important that we come together as a society.
I think we're seeing this happening across many different universities, trying to force more and more workers into precarious contract types of employment.
In this edition, voices from the picket lines of the QP 3903 strike at York University. A feature on the new four-in, four-out policy leading to mass deportation of migrant workers. Voices from the streets of Montreal as Quebec students mobilize against austerity measures. And community members in Thunder Bay gather in ceremony to honor Cindy Gladue.
But first, here are the headlines. CKUT's Antoine Cadeau brings us news of Haitian and Zimbabweans currently resisting deportation in Montreal.
On Friday, the 20th of March, the first demonstration was held in Montreal to protest against the possible deportation of 3,000 non-status migrants from Haiti and Zimbabwe. The protests were organized by a joint Haitian-Zimbabwean community group called the Non-Status Action Committee, as well as Solidarity Across Border. In December, the Canadian government lifted a moratorium on deportation to Haiti and Zimbabwe, hence leaving thousands of people from those communities in Canada vulnerable to deportations. Non-status Haitian and Zimbabwean now have to apply for residence permits based on humanitarian and compassionate grounds. During the demonstration, members of the community told Groundwire that they refused the humanitarian procedure because it causes discrimination among migrants. They demand a full regularization and refuse a discriminatory case-per-case procedure. Olivier Louis, from the Non-Status Action Committee, underlined the fact that under humanitarian and compassionate procedures, only 20% of cases received a positive answer. Meanwhile, members of those communities in Canada have been living under the fear of being separated from their families and communities. The organizers claim that they will be in front of complex Guy Favreau to defend their cause until the government agrees to change the procedure. This is Antoine Cadeau from CKUT reporting for Groundwire.
Spring has started with a bang in the province of Quebec as 50,000 post-secondary students began a two-week strike on March 21st. The strike, which is the first mass student mobilization since the now infamous Maple Spring of 2012, has been called in opposition to Premier Philippe Couillard's austerity measures and cuts in education, healthcare, and other social services. The students are hoping that their actions will push towards a larger general strike later this spring and are encouraging labor unions and other community sector groups to join in. The strike started with a demonstration of thousands of people in downtown Montreal on March 21st and was followed by a series of direct actions and spirited night marches, several of which were violently attacked by riot police. On March 24th, several McGill students with the group Demilitarize McGill blockaded the James Administration Building to protest against the university's complicity in austerity cuts in education, as well as weapons research on campus. CKUT's Ashwarya Singh was at that action and spoke with Cadence O'Neill from Demilitarize McGill.
So I think that as austerity, as like cuts to public education, as cuts to funding of universities come in more and more from the government, the university is able to kind of like explain away or like rationalize their reliance on military research and military contracts. So even though these cuts are real and they are really affecting McGill, it's a political choice what universities choose to invest in or like what universities choose to like align themselves with. And so I think that like as austerity is like accelerated, the university is able to kind of use that as an excuse to justify what they've been doing all along, which is like aligning themselves with colonialism and imperialism via weapons development.
The strike is set to build up to a mass demonstration against austerity in Montreal on April 2nd. The Education Ministry has already threatened to cancel the semester if the strike continues past April 2nd, but student associations could vote in General Assemblies to extend it. For Groundwire, this is Aaron Lakoff from CKUT Radio in Montreal.
We also thank Ashwarya Singh and Stefan Christoph from CKUT for the additional audio recordings used in that report. Stay tuned for more on the Quebec student strikes in our feature stories.
That's it for the headlines.
Now it's time for our feature stories. A new temporary foreign worker policy going into effect April 1st will limit migrant workers to working in Canada to 4 years. Mina Ramos from CFRU in Guelph brings this feature story.
On April 1, 2015, the 4-and-4 rule, a policy initially passed in 2011, will take effect and force thousands of migrant workers coming under the NOC C and D sector of the Temporary Foreign Workers Program to leave the country. I sat down with Lalo Niliaki from Fuerza Puerza, a migrant advocacy group based out of Guelph, Ontario, and Sasna Miranda Leal from the Migrant Workers Alliance for Change to talk about the rule and how affected workers are reacting to the policy. Can you explain what the 4-and-4 rule is and how it will affect migrant workers?
It's a piece of regulation, immigration regulation, that was enacted in April 1st of 2011 that says that temporary foreign workers, specifically low-wage temporary foreign workers in Canada, will only be able to work 4 years in Canada and then will have to leave for another 4 years before they can come back or try to renew their work permits.
Not all sections of the Temporary Foreign Workers Program are going to be affected by this rule. From my understanding, it is low-skilled workers that are going to be affected. And so what are the industries that these quote-unquote low-skilled workers are employed in?
I think that's a really good thing to point out. It's just important to dispel kind of some of these categories, because we know that the work that people are doing, that it does fall under these low-skilled categories that people often talk about. It's difficult work. It's highly skilled work as well. You know, some of the industries that then would fall under low-skilled work and are affected by this policy are people, for example, working in manufacturing jobs, food processing plants, restaurants, agriculture as well. There's another program that other migrant workers are coming under that's called the SOP program. Workers under that program are being exempted from this rule, but other farm workers that are here working the whole year, they are included under this policy, so they will come under the four-year rule. So yeah, we know a lot of agriculture workers coming from Guatemala, from Thailand, from the Philippines.
Also, a big group of workers that will have to abide by this rule are living caregivers. And I think a lot of folks are confused, because living caregivers do have access to permanent residency if they're able to get 2 years of work in Canada and then become eligible to apply to stay and bring their families. However, this rule does apply to them. And the truth is, not all living caregivers are able to get those 2 years of work experience before those 4 years run up. For example, if a woman has to leave her job for whatever reason, if she's suffering any sort of labor abuse at work, or if there's a disagreement, she has to leave her employer for any reason, it might be quite a few months before she can find a new employer, and then a few months extra before that employer can apply to the federal government to hire her, and then she has to get a work permit. So there's a lot of time that goes by in between work permits that can easily amount to enough so that the worker will not have started her application for permanent residency before those 4 years come up.
Now, these laws take effect April 1st, 2015, which is coming up. How are workers and advocates responding to this policy?
In different communities, advocacy groups and the communities that they're working with are definitely showing resistance to this policy. People are pretty frustrated.
There's a lot of concern. There's a lot of panic among workers and in migrant communities about what their options are, what they're going to do. So advocates all across Canada are planning actions. There's been actions all month in opposition to this regulation.
And so from what you're saying, it doesn't really seem like this is a policy that workers are really for. On the flip side of it, what kinds of changes do workers want to be seeing to the Temporary Foreign Workers Program as a whole?
In Ontario, we're pushing for, right now there's a public review of the Employment Standards Act, and we're pushing for stronger provincial protections regarding work, but also housing, health and safety, workers' compensation. At the federal level, we want workers to have access to full benefits, so access to EI, access to EI special benefits such as parental benefits. or sickness leaves. Ultimately, what makes the biggest difference in migrant workers' access to rights across the country is status. If the need for these workers has been in existence for the last 40, 50, 60 years, in the case of caregivers, then these jobs are clearly not temporary. It is what we call permanently temporary work. These workers will not have real access to justice until they have the same immigration status.
For those interested in challenging this policy, where can they find more info?
All of the events are on Facebook. Look us up as the Migrant Worker Alliance for Change on Facebook, and you'll be able to see the different events listed there. But they're also on the Tumblr campaign site that was set up against the 4&4 rule. And so that is no4and4.tumblr.com.
That was Mina Ramos reporting from CFRU in Guelph.
Alex Gellis brings us an in-depth look at why QP 3903 members are on strike at York University in Toronto. The strike began on March 3rd, and as of March 29th, a tentative settlement has been reached between the bargaining team and York University. It is expected to be ratified in a vote within the following days.
Why are we here?
I am on strike in solidarity with our other units, master's students and contract faculty.
The main reason we're here is like actually just trying to take a principled stand against some of the policies and the dynamics that the university continues to try and push on everyone. And I think we're seeing this happening across many different universities, trying to force more and more workers into precarious contract types of employment. And so I think one of the main things we're pushing back against is that very style of organizing labor today.
Well, I think there's some major issues on the bargaining table for each of the three units in QP 3903. Unit 1 represents TAs, teaching assistants, who run the tutorials at the university.
I am out here on the picket line on strike because for Unit 1, our biggest thing that we're fighting for to be in our contract is the maintenance of our language around tuition indexation. So what tuition indexation is that it's a clause in our contract that says if our tuition goes up, our compensation also goes up. And this is something that previous QP 3903 members went on strike for back in 2001. And it's because of their success and their win in having the tuition indexation language in the contract that I, who am from a working class family, am able to do graduate school because our tuition levels are low.
We are here because we are on strike because we cannot get a collective agreement with our employer, York University, that we are happy with. For my unit, we are looking for job security. We have 1,200 members, and what we're being offered right now in this contract is protection for 27 of them. What that means is 27 of them would have long-term contracts, while the rest of us have short-term contracts where we apply for a job once or twice a year if we want to work in the spring-summer term. And we never know what we're teaching, and we often get called a couple of weeks before and say, can you teach this course? And it's hard to teach in an environment where there's no predictability. You can't order textbooks. You don't know who your students will be. You don't get to know your students from year to year because you don't know if you're here or not. You can't write them reference letters.
In the third unit in QP 3903 is Unit 3. These are students who perform research work and graduate work alongside professors. They help them do research, they help them in the laboratory, and they help them plan for their graduate level and other courses.
Another reason why I'm on strike and many other people in Unit 1 who are PhD students is to support our fellow union members in Unit 3 who are master's students. Right now, they don't have a minimum guarantee for funding. So funding depends on what faculty you're in. It can range from $8,000 to $12,000. We're currently fighting so that they can have a minimum guarantee of a funding package of $15,000.
We're also striking for indexation because arguably GAs might have the most to lose if it gets taken away. Some people are talking about indexation as being unwinnable because it'll cost York a lot of money, something like $2 million. In fact, indexation is something we've already won. It's something that can only now be taken away. The university already budgets for indexation. So what they're calling a cost is actually simply a loss of revenue. There's a big difference there.
We want to make sure that post-secondary education is as accessible as it can be.
We're going to continue to fight, and this is not just for us, but this is actually the future of all students coming to York and hopefully other universities across Canada. So, you know, in solidarity, we keep fighting until we get, you know, the deal, you know, we all deserve.
And I think it's really important to recognize that we actually already have this. Those of us who are studying and who are walking the picket lines, we have it. We're protected. But the university is trying to take it away for future students. And that's what we're fighting for right now. And that's what's so important to me as an educator. When I stand in front of my classroom, I want to know that my students will be able to access a graduate education in the same way I could.
Thank you to Alex Gellis for this report.
Celia Robinovich from CKUT brings us to the streets of Montreal on March 21st, the beginning of a mass mobilization of students in Quebec against austerity measures.
On Saturday, March 21st, thousands of people marched through the streets of Montreal to kick off a two-week student strike in Quebec. The march was the first of a series of weekly demonstrations organized by the Comité Printemps 2015, a collective that works to unite students and workers in the anti-austerity movement.
And so, how does austerity affect you?
Directly. It's strong because you don't feel it right away. You don't. It's not directly to you. It's always someone near you. It's my friends that cannot send their child to a CPE, un centre de la petite enfance, you know, because they want to cut, you know, they want to make us be like we're not humans. I think that's the problem. Well, the difference between 2012 and 2015 is that that's the thing. We don't feel it right away, but we know that there's all these cuts that are going to do on education, in the health system. We know that it's going to directly affect my sister who's pregnant. It's going to directly affect her because it's going to be really, really much expenses for her just to send her child to SCPE. So it scares me because I know that child is just going to come to this society who they were preparing us, I believe. They were preparing for a couple of decades, but it scares me so much just to know that my nephew is not going to have what I used to have. He'd be able to go to university just because, you know, he has to get this loan just to pay thousands and thousands that we're not used. And the thing is that the income doesn't follow. The income that we receive doesn't follow that. It doesn't affect us directly, say, the students who had this big movement on 2012. But it's like a global thing. And that's what scares me the most. I think it's more scary than 2012. I think people don't feel something that affects directly. I think it's just this thing that they want to make it global just to make you believe that it's the way to go.
Yeah. But
why are you here today?
Because it means a lot for me to come here and protest with my family.
What does your sign say?
Let's refuse austerity.
How does austerity impact you?
It impacts me a lot because In the future, it will affect me a lot because the government is making cuts to all of the public services. So it's important to come out on the streets and send a message to society.
So, what sign are you holding?
We roll point gun.
And can you tell me a little bit about it?
In French?
It's okay.
Okay. Plateforme à revendication sociale.
It is a platform for social activism that will launch in July. This platform will enable people to create social change and then to build collective action plans.
What action has it been taking so far?
It will inspire people to engage in social activism by helping them organize their collective action plans, whether it be demonstrations, petitions, or boycotts, and have access to products and services that will achieve their ideas for social change.
For Groundwire, I'm Celia Rabinovich reporting from CKUT in Montreal.
Demonstrations are taking place across Turtle Island in protest of the recent acquittal of the man who murdered Cindy Gladue. On a snowy Sunday morning, 50 community members gathered in ceremony to honor Cindy Gladue. I spoke with some of the community members who helped organize the ceremony in Thunder Bay.
My name is Rita Fenton. I'm from the Fort William First Nation. My spirit name is Mikisi Ikwe, Eagle Woman. The importance of honoring Cindy Gladue as we come together as Native peoples is that, you know, the injustices that are done to Native people throughout history, and we've always come through, we've always remained strong and stayed together, and we gather together in ceremony to honor and respect our missing, murdered and missing women and men and children. So we always as a community come together so to unify ourselves and we always have that respect. We're non-violent people. We always do it in ceremony and with the Creator as our guide.
I'm Damian Lee from Fort William First Nation, next to Thunder Bay, Ontario. So we thought it was really important to come out today here in Thunder Bay to honor Cindy Gladue, to make sure that she's centered in the public conversation that's happening about her and about her case and about missing and murdered Indigenous women. It's important that she stays at the center of this because of the fact that she's a human being and who lost her life and who a lot of people believe was robbed of justice. That there's a long history in North America of Indigenous people's bodies being taken apart and put in museums and put on display and dismembered and brought around for various different reasons. So the fact that part of her body was brought into a courtroom and apparently was one of the only second time that coroner saw that, that smacks of a very dark and ugly history. And so I know that a lot of people are upset about that fact, and I think that a number of us here are questioning whether or not having her pelvis brought into a courtroom as a piece of evidence was necessary, and especially from when put into that broader context, I think we need to keep that context in mind in terms of how Indigenous bodies are being abused and used and treated. And I would wonder if there's a parallel between that history and the way that she was murdered and the way that that man felt that her body could be used and in the way that the whole court proceedings treated her body. I wonder if there's parallels there in terms of how Indigenous bodies are treated.
My name is Jana Ray Yerksa, and I'm Anishinaabe from Kuchiching First Nation, but living here in Thunder Bay. I don't even know where to begin in terms of talking about how important it is to come together and in ceremony and honor Cindy Gladue. It really, really disturbed me what happened to her in terms of how she was killed. And it was more disturbing in terms of the way her body was handled in court and the court ruling in terms of an acquittal. And I think that when we look at the violence that Indigenous women experience that we experience because of the history of colonialism and the ongoing colonization of Canada. We bear the brunt of that violence, and you know, what happened to Cindy is unacceptable, and I think it's so important that we come together as a society and let her family know, let her children know that we care, that we are paying attention, that we love her. And, you know, the only way this is going to stop is if we all start to pay attention and do things differently. In terms of us organizing this event, we didn't have names on the poster in terms of who was organizing it. A lot of people were wondering, you know, who was in charge. And, you know, nobody was in charge. It really was a community kind of thing. You know, we got together with a bunch of people, made tobacco ties, and asked people to come together, you know, the women's drum group. And, you know, that was really purposeful in terms of advertising our ceremony today, wanting people to come out and welcoming them, was because we really wanted the focus to remain on Cindy Gladue and not on an organization per se or a group per se, but to remain on Cindy.
Now it's time for the Community Radio Report. To help celebrate Rendezvous de la Francophonie, 9 NCRA member stations from across Canada each produced 17 daily 2-minute audio capsules that document local Francophone culture and the importance of bilingualism. Ophira Horowitz spoke with one of the producers at CFFF at Trent Radio in Peterborough.
Hello, my name is Cassia Abelt Leduc, and I live in Peterborough. I go to Monseigneur Gemmel. Rendezvous de la Francophonie. It's like a festival to celebrate like the culture and the language throughout Canada. And this year it went from the 6th to the 22nd of March. One of this year's like events to celebrate the festival was providing a grant to some of the radio programmers across Canada to make 17 short shows to celebrate the French language and culture. The grant is important because there are French communities across Canada, and this grant allows radio programmers a chance to talk about French culture to an English-speaking audience. For example, I live in Peterborough, which is mainly English speaking, and like through these shows you might not be able to learn how to speak the language fluently, but you will be able to learn like aspects of the French culture and that, and I find that pretty important. When my dad first told me about the grant, I thought it was just going to be in Peterborough, and I thought it was just like a little thing, just a little festival happening in Peterborough to recognize the French culture. But then when we were finished, then we learned that it was throughout Canada, and I was represent one of the people representing Ontario. Now I'm getting interviewed, and for me that's just kind of crazy.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced by Carly Forbes on Anishinaabe Territory in Thunder Bay. Headlines this week were written by Antoine Cadeau and Aaron Lakoff. We also thank Stefan Khrushchev, Ophira Horowitz, Aishwarya Singh, Celia Rabinovich, Alex Gellis, and Mina Ramos.
Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station on rabble.ca or download at groundwire.ncra.ca. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.